Adrian Young aus Los Angeles hat viel um die Ohren. Er schreibt und produziert Musik, ist Jurist, Labelbetreiber, Studiobesitzer und Inhaber eines Plattenladens und Friseursalons. Durch und durch Hip-Hop sind seine Produktionen auf Songs von Jay-Z, Kendrick Lamar oder Schoolboy Q vertreten. Mit Ghostface Killah vom Wu-Tang Clan und den Source of Mischief hat er ganze Alben aufgenommen. Inzwischen hat er beim Hip-Hop eine Pause eingelegt und sich dem Soul und Jazz der späten 60er und frühen 70er zugewandt. In der Pandemiepause im eigenen Studio und nur mit analogem Vintage-Equipment entstand sein neues Album The American Negro, das am 26. Februar über das eigene Jazz Is Dead-Label erscheint. Mit The American Negro will Adrian Young vor allem eins: aufklären, bilden, Awareness schaffen. Musikalisch ist das mit einer Mischung aus Motown-Sound, Gospelcore und hochpolitischen Spoken Word bereits gelungen. Ich habe mich mit dem wie immer schick angezogen und eloquenten Produzenten zum Interview verabredet und ihn gefragt, in welchem Kontext die Aufnahmen zum neuen Album begonnen haben.
I actually started the project in March at the beginning of quarantine because everything was shut down. I said, oh, this is my time to do it. And I was probably a third into the album and then the incident with George Floyd happened. And then I said, wow, this is so serendipitous because everyone in the world is protesting right now against racial injustice. And my album has even more meaning in the moment, even though I know that whenever it comes out, it will still have some sort of meaning. So that's basically it in a nutshell.
You just mentioned like knowledge and the sort of education, because that's also something that I felt. I don't know if the title is a reference to Booker T. Washington, but you certainly have this interlude called Double Consciousness. So the the sense of looking at oneself through the eyes of the other, W.E.B. Du Bois. Was there like a lot of like African-American criticism that went into this album also for you, like as a, I don't know, I'm assuming you've read a lot of like those books along the way, but did that also like again like went into the album production?
It's more about American criticism, but the nucleus of this is really the evolution, the ideology of racism in America, which pioneered a new concept of racism. So racism is a result of slavery. Slavery is not a result of racism. And in America, our capitalistic structure was manifested under the concept of subjugating human beings to chattel or property under the doctrine of manifest destiny, which is the concept that the white race is entitled to rule the world, and the white race is at the top. They are the supreme. This is the white supremacist perspective, and everybody out here is essentially born to serve our will. And that is the theory behind slavery in America, because America pioneered the concept of perpetual slavery, whereby if you are enslaving somebody, their offspring now belongs to you and is of your property. So the album really talks about the evolution of racism in America, so people understand how much these machinations connect to all of the nefarious things that are still happening today.
You said that, you know, the goal of the album is like to restore dignity, self-worth. Now, one could say that particularly in the period that you are most interested in musically, like late 60s, early 70s, soul music certainly challenged already like racial self-hatred and build community pride. In your own thoughts, like what has happened? You know, like soul music had this big momentum in the, let's say, early 70s. And here we are in 2020 and you're creating an album like The American Negro. In your own, like, what do you think? Like what happened precisely? Why is that Why is that album still so current and will never be out of date?
So if we go back and we look at jazz, jazz is a hybrid of the blues with Western classical confinement, right?
Yeah.
So what happened here was that jazz cats learned Western theory and said, we're not going to be locked into these parameters anymore. We're going to expound upon the music and go further and break all the rules. And we are going to prove that us as Black people are not just feeble-minded individuals. We're not just idiot savants. We are as intellectual as any other human being, and we can make music that is of the same class of classical music, but do it in our own syncopated way. For that was the first form of protest music that disseminated around the world, jazz being the first form of American music that really went around the world, right? Obviously we had Negro spirituals and all that stuff before that and blues, but the first form of music that really caught wave around the world that outside that left America was jazz. So jazz started this concept of freedom music. And then with soul music, with James Brown, Say It Black and I'm Proud, Say It Loud, I'm Black and I'm Proud. And Curtis Mayfield, like, there was this new Black consciousness. There was this new perspective whereby Blacks were seeking to remind and re-educate all minorities on how important and equal they are, because minorities have been facing insurmountable handicaps in order to prosper in life. And one of these handicaps was, just like you said, this concept of double consciousness, where, you know, you would see yourself in the mirror and you would know who you are, you would see yourself, but then you're also seeing yourself through the vantage point of white imperialism. You're seeing yourself the vantage point of overdetermined stereotypes that tell you you are the face of evil, that tell you that you are not good enough to be who you should be. So soul music helped to reinvent the way we saw each other, despite what our institutions were telling us. Hip hop came along and took that to a whole new brazen level with cats like Public Enemy and even NWA and other conscious rappers. And the question is whether that's still going on today. People are still talking about how we need to be better. But there's the Black consciousness that we have right now is not the same that we had in the late 60s and early 70s, that's right after the civil rights era, that's right when Vietnam was going on, because everybody was feeling it. They were feeling the heat. It was not as disguised back then as it is now. So a lot of people, you could ask a lot of, you know, conservative people here, is there such thing as racism, institutionalized racism? Oh no, blah, blah. But what's happening is that they just can't see it. You know, they can't see it. Back then, you could at least see it. If there's something called separate but equal, you could use this fountain, but not this fountain, or this bathroom that versus that back bathroom. At least it's more brazen. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there should be more music that serves to educate people on where we live, because music is a different type of pontification. It's a different way to teach people things that they otherwise wouldn't listen to if you were in front of them talking to them about it.
Yes, that's right. You just mentioned very visible racism, and you also have that on your album cover, which, you know, is a take on postcards created of lynchings in the first part of the 20th century, which is a brilliant cover. I mean, it is as brilliant as it is disturbing, but it's certainly already intriguing. Like, you want to listen to that album, imagine what it sounds like. Is that something, also if I compare it to like other like album covers from the Jazz Is Dead catalog, was that something that kind of like came from your background as a crate digger, sort of to, I'll already make this album cover, which is so striking that people basically have no choice but to listen to it?
Well, I mean, just as an artist, I always want to have a striking album cover because I feel like what I'm doing is important. I always do. And my perspective anytime I create an album is that, why should anybody care about what I'm doing? I always got to give them a reason to care about it, first of all. Secondly, the reason why I have that album cover is, as you poignantly stated, is to educate people on the fact that Black men have been lynched for centuries in America, and the lynching of Black men had been celebrated. And these lynching postcards were celebratory memorabilia that people would pass around to show that they were there. And they're celebrating the fact that vigilante justice, and I say vigilante justice in quotations, took place because Black people are the face of evil, you know? And also, lynching is a form of dying by asphyxiation, just like George Floyd being choked, mm-hmm. just like Eric Garner being choked. So the album cover says so many different things that I could have a full discussion just on what that means. But basically, it's there to show the value of a Black man, that Black man being myself. And also, something that's crazy is that when I took that photo and I had that rope around my neck, I had a real moment, because this is how it feels before you die by a lynch, by being lynched by a rope. And it was a scary feeling. It like, just feeling that pressure on my neck was very scary. So anyway, that cover represents a lot.
Mm. You just mentioned the killings of George Floyd or Eric Garner. And what I was wondering about, you have three tracks on the album that, you know, are named after real people. James Mincy Jr. was killed by police in 1982. Margaret Garner, who killed her child rather than let it go back to slavery and served as the basis for Toni Morrison's Beloved, and George Stinney Jr., who was wrongly executed at age 14. So these are like three African-American fates that are still representative. But why did you choose them, these three people, these three fates?
I chose them because there are three people that no one ever talks about. And there's there's thousands of people that no one ever talks about. And I picked them because they are from different eras, different generations. Mm-hmm. And to show that this is a cyclical occurrence. This stuff, this bigotry, this death due to bigotry, due to discrimination, has been happening for years, and it's still happening, and people need to wake up and speak about it and talk about it. And also, I use these names so that when I'm speaking with people like yourself, we can have, as we are having, very intellectual discussions regarding something that's just beyond music, regarding something that affects our lives, that affects our children's lives, that affects people, the way people live, you know? And I mean, I've been doing press for a very long time. And it's always cool to say, hey man, why did you want to write a song about love? Or like, why did you use this instrument and all that stuff? I mean, I love that. I can talk about all that all day. That's my life. But when I get to also talk about making a place better for my children, your children, our friends, our parents and all that stuff, I mean, there's not a greater high for me, man. It's like a spiritual thing for me.
Yes. If I can go back to, let's say, theory one more time, on the title track, you say, I am an African-American struggling with my allegiance to the motherland.
Yes.
I was wondering if you could elaborate on that a little bit, whether, like, I don't know, whether you're struggling, for example, with the concept of Pan-Africanism or what you precisely meant by that.
Yeah, people that are listening don't even know the depth of what you're talking about. like what you're saying some things that have so much weight and meaning, and I really appreciate it. I hope they research just the little things that you're saying.
Well, and that's what we do at the college radio, at least I'm trying to do my part.
You're doing it. Just connecting this to the concept of Pan-Africanism, which is the concept of going back to your roots as a Black man in America, going back to Africa. These were theories that were thrown around throughout the years, you know, by Marcus Garvey and many others. And unbeknownst to many, former presidents like Abraham Lincoln and Thomas Jefferson were trying to were seriously talking about ways just to send Blacks to Africa, because Blacks were considered America's problem and still are in many ways. So the song, The American Negro, talks about the pejorative term of choice. Do we call ourselves Negro, colored, African-American, coon, spick, tar baby? Like, what do we call ourselves? Because we're the only group that went to America that has no language of our own, right? Because we weren't allowed to have our own language. We were stripped of our culture. So by calling the album, by calling this song The American Negro, the term Negro is an antiquated term that is now not a term that is widely accepted by Black people. At the time, it was like, oh, you calling me Negro instead of nigger? Oh my God, thank you for showing me so much respect. You calling me colored? Thank you for showing me so much respect. But with the Black Power movement, with that consciousness, we all kind of came to the conclusion that, yo, we are Black. And we are proud. We are Black. And this is what we are. And this concept of being African-American, my parents came from South America, Guyana. So obviously everybody came from Africa. Mitochondrial Eve is from Africa. You know, that's where the first human is found, right? But the point is, do I struggle with my allegiance to the motherland? I do. Because I know I do have an allegiance to the motherland, but I have no real connection because I've traveled the entire world. I still have not been to Africa yet. I still want to go to Africa. But look how Africa is broadcasted around the world. You know, if there's a war or if there's problems in Africa, it doesn't make our news. If there's something going on in Germany or France or Russia, it'll make our news. But a place that where there's such a dense Black population, hell no, it's not going to make our news. And what does that say to Black people like myself, Black Americans like myself? In a way, it puts Africa in the background and it continues to sever our connection with the motherland. So it's something, this Pan-African concept is something that a lot of Black people are still struggling with, you know?
Okay, let's quickly talk album sound, because that was like a lot of theory. I think sound wise, like what I really heard was, on the one hand, like Marvin Gaye's What's Going On, particularly then, you know, like with a song like Watch the Children, Save the Children, but of course also Gil Scott Heron's Pieces of a Man, both albums that incidentally turn 50 this year. I don't know, like if those records were like
on target. You're absolutely on target. I mean, I wanted to make an album that was as if Marvin Gaye hooked up with a James Baldwin to produce something by David Axelrod, you know, and bringing in Stevie and, you know, all these cats. Like, that's exactly what this is. So sonically, I mean, as we discussed, like my favorite, my golden era of recordings between 68 and 73. So sonically, I wanted to stay in that area. But I also wanted to represent Black excellence to the fullest. I wanted it to be opulent as hell. And also in creating this album, I basically enslaved myself because I played every single instrument of the rhythm section. Mm. And then on top of that, I wrote for an orchestra to come in and record the orchestra. So like you're hearing pieces of me all over the place, from drums to flute to sax to clarinet to keys to guitar, all that stuff, right? It's all me. It's all me pouring my heart into one project that means more to me than anything else I created, you know? So, you know, I tried to just make it as interesting and as beautiful and dark as possible.
Yeah, I figured it's certainly the most Adrian Young album to date. One question that might be a little bit nerdy, but I'm really intrigued, particularly by the bass sound, certainly on the title track, also on other tracks, because I think you achieved like a very singing double bass type of sounds, even though I think there is no double bass on it. So was it also like, again, a Fender P bass?
So I always say to people when it comes, so first of all, everything I do is analog. There is no computers in my recording, right? So when it comes to the sound of recording, right? I always say to musicians that if you want to be the best you can be, you should learn how to engineer, because then you can play and compose all those things that were in your head with nobody getting in your way. Same thing I always tell people, learn how to write music, learn how to write for orchestras. You could do, there's nothing that could stop you after that. So when it comes to bass sounds, like to me, the two most difficult things to record are bass and drums. So, you know, I've been doing it for over 20 years. And I always say that new music to me are old records I've never heard before, because I love old records and I love the sound that they capture.
That still applies.
Hell yeah, dude. I have a record store, the R-Form Studio out here. Like, I love old records, and that's new music to me, records, old records I never heard before. So my bass sound is a chain, you know, so I'm using predominantly, most of what I use is like an old Fender P bass. And then I run it through an old Fender Bantam amp, and then record it with a condenser through a Veritube Federal limiter, and record to 2-inch tape. And that's it, you know, because a microphone could catch the sound from the speaker. I don't record straight in. I want to hear the air. So I use a Sony C500 microphone, like an early 70s condenser for that. And it's all, my whole chain is tube down to a 2-inch tape machine. So like, it's not going to sound, it can't sound whack. It has to sound good, you know? And also I tell people that the bass guitar is a guitar. So don't use it as something that is merely just subs. Use it as a guitar, sing with it, because if you listen to the bass playing throughout the album, I'm getting away with so much movement because it's in a lower register. If that was a guitar or something like, or in a higher register, I couldn't do all that stuff because it would not mesh well with all my other counter melodies.
Okay, that was a nerdy answer. Thank you very much.
It's all good, man. I love this.
Also, I think like a big part of the sound is kind of like this, in parts almost, it's almost like a call and response between you and the choir, which again has like this unison, almost like Greek drama type of choir. Was that like also like an inspiration? Because that would be interesting inspiration that you drew it from ancient Greek drama or just like theater in general.
What is interesting that you say that, because the group aspect is for me is like old black gospel shit. So like if you're in a church and the preacher's saying something and then they're supposed to read a scripture or something, that's what it's really supposed to be. It reminds me of being young and being bored as hell in church, and I'm listening there. But at the same time, all of my didactic, all of my speaking on here, I'm taking a very professorial approach to the teaching of racism. And I wanted to do it in a way that is more hypnotizing. And I felt like by having the delay on my voice and by having them, it's kind of hypnotic and different and weird in a cool way. So as far as what you were saying about like this Greek chanting and all that stuff, it's all the same kind of thing. Because where is gospel and all that stuff derivative from? So it all makes sense, you know?
You consider yourself like an artist, sort of like favorite musician of your favorite musician. And the American Negro certainly is a big piece of education that also, you know, like takes you away a little bit. I mean, it's been a while since you've been doing hip hop music. But I was wondering, since you know, like you work with people like Kendrick or Ghostface, whether that is something that is still on your radar, that you're still up to, particularly from that education perspective. Because I mean, I guess particularly someone like Kendrick Lamar was really someone who was able to kind of like infuse mainstream culture with like black cultural critique.
Well, look at it like this. I mean, I'm hip hop to the core, no matter what I create, right? So I have this question quite often. I love making hip hop music, but when I'm making hip hop music, I'm limited, right? Yeah. So if you listen to all the musical chord changes and the melodies and all that stuff that I have on the American Negro, I can only do that as an instrumental and or with a singer that is falling in line with the melody. If somebody's rapping over that, I can't have all that music in there because it gets in the way. It gets in the way of their diction. So anytime I'm creating a hip hop album, I know that I can't go in as deep as I want to musically. And I love going in deep musically. So like I'm definitely gonna have some more hip hop albums. I haven't in a while. But you know, when I do, but like, I just love making just music so much, man. Oh, and just, you know, I'm a real like instrumentalist, you know, so.
That you certainly bring that hip hop flavor into that music. Like for me, in parts, the American Negro almost sounded like I said, a Marvin Gaye record, but sort of is if, for example, RZA wrote the music and not like Holland, Dozier Holland. That's
Holland
sounded to me like. But speaking of hip hop, whatever happened to that project with Snoop Dogg?
We're just waiting for it to come out, man. Like it's done. It's been done. Like it's big and beautiful. and it's deep, dude. I mean, 30-piece orchestra. It sound like how you hear this album. It's deep, just like this one. And it's interesting because I just said that I can do something as deep with a rapper, but it's just now that you mentioned that album and comparing that to this, it is pretty deep musically, but it's a different kind of musical depth because I got to choose my spaces. I can't go deep from the beginning of song to the end. I could go deep in the chorus and maybe deep at the end and maybe deep at the introduction. But the depth is still there, you know.
Okay. And for me personally, because that was sort of my my introduction to your music, third record with Ghostface at any point in the future, maybe?
We'll see, man. We'll see. I don't know. I think I would say I want to get this Snoop album out before I do another hip hop album, probably. So we'll see.
That is a topic that I certainly like care about is Brazilian music, and you're certainly one of those artists that I would consider experts on that field, sort of with you know, people like Madlib, for example. So I was wondering, because now, you know, like I can talk to someone who has really been digging for Brazilian music, what, coming from a hip hop context, was the first like time you heard Brazilian music, like Brazilian samples? Many people say it's J Dilla's Beat for Running. I don't know.
You know, the first time is actually Tribe Called Quest, Midnight Marauders, because the tour guide music.
Yeah, right.
That song is written by Joao Donato, and then it was covered by Cal Jader, because Cal Jader was actually playing. I mean, Joao Donato was playing with Cal Jader. So hearing that music, you're hearing a Brazilian song. And sample, that's the first time I heard a Brazilian sample.
I don't know if you might be aware of that, but that was something that I was wondering about. A lot of the music that you know, that is considered the most brilliant music, be it by, like Marcos Valle, Azimut, all those people, stems from sort of like your preferred era as well, like late 60s mm-hmm. up until like mid 70s, which is also the core era of the military dictatorship. So I was wondering, like, when you dig for Brazilian records from that era, be it like knowingly or unknowingly, do you end up like researching a little bit, I don't know, like the context, for example, in which that music was created? I mean, you certainly get to the point, I guess, when you end up talking to people like Marcos Valle or Arthur Verocai.
Yeah, well, I mean, when I'm listening to Brazilian music, I have no idea what they're talking about. I'm not as smart as you, dude. I only speak one language, bro. So for me, the music speaks to me all the time. So that when I actually meet with them, I talk to them about what was happening when they were making this and when they were making that. You know, I talk to Verocai about when he made that, how the label like didn't want to support it, and they looked at him like he was crazy. Or Marcos Valle, when he was making protest music, he had to do it in a very clandestine manner, you know, because he didn't want to get in trouble with the government. He had left, you know, he had came to Los Angeles when he was dealing with all the dictatorship and all that stuff, and Joao Donato, all that stuff. So like, I love to hear their stories about what it was like at that time, and how they had to leave and come back, and how they dealt with it, and how they used music as an outlet. And it's very inspiring, you know, very, very inspiring.
It's also fascinating that music from that era, particularly if you look at, I don't know, people like Marcos Valle or Elis Regina, you know, Marcos Valle, like the whitest Brazilian possible, wrote a song called Black is Beautiful, which was then sung by another white singer. But that they, particularly if you compare that, I guess, to like white US Americans at that point, they had like certainly like a different outlook on race, and almost like the musicians themselves, like a sort of racial ambiguity. I don't know, maybe that is also why, I guess, that music from that country and that particular era is so exciting.
Yeah, I mean, you know, in Brazil, they push the concept that there is no race, it's just Brazilian, you're just Brazilian, but there's a lot of racism out there. I don't know what the hell they get that shit from. But what's really cool is that when anybody's singing or creating a song to uplift another race that's not theirs, that's very honorable, you know, it's very cool.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much for listening to you.
Thank you very much, brother. Good talking to you.
And I hope you don't mind being quoted in my MA thesis that I'm writing right now.
Go for it. I would love to. I'd be honored, man. Thank you.
Appreciate it. Thank you. Have a great day.
Okay. Bye-bye.